You get out of there, you hear me? Hart told Saltlicker, who stamped and snorted. The stallion was already jittery, sensing the wrongness of this place. Hart had been hoping to steer with his knees to keep both hands free for pistol crossbows, but there was no way that was going to work now. He'd have to hold the reins in his left hand, leaving him with only a single six-shooter in his right hand to protect himself. So be it, he thought. For the 10th time in as many minutes, he made sure the pistol crossbows in his holsters were loaded. He slid the rapier in and out of the scabbard and touched the handle of each machete strapped to his back. The dagger on his arm was unfamiliar and uncomfortable, but he left it. Better to be overarmed than underarmed. He blew out a breath, as if he could cast his roiling thoughts into the wind along with it. Then he wrapped the reins around his left hand and kicked Saltlicker's sides. The stallion launched from the trees into the open field, but he immediately began to fight the reins, trying to turn back as the first drudges stepped into their path. Hart pulled hard, keeping him on course. He took careful aim and pulled the trigger, taking down one of the drudges. The soul slipped out of the body as more drudges scrambled onto the field, putting themselves between him and the house. He fired another shot and missed, then another, taking out a second infected corpse. Another shot. Another. Another. He streaked across the meadow on the panicking stallion, barely keeping the creature in line as he tossed aside the empty pistol crossbow and pulled out the next. A few drudges dropped and released their souls, but more came, then more and more, a growing barrier between Hart and his destination. He grabbed the last crossbow from its holster, and when that was empty too, he slid a machete from his back. Equimaris and Ryder plunged into the bodies. Hart tried to hack a pathway through, but before he broke to the other side, Saltlicker shrieked, a sound that splintered the twilight. The stallion bucked hard, kicking out at drudges and casting his rider into the throng. Hart smashed into bodies, fresh and rotted alike, losing his grip on the machete. A sea of drudges surrounded him, pulling him under. Teeth sank into the flesh of his shoulder, his stomach, his calf, an exquisite symphony of pain. A skeletal hand wrapped around his throat. He grabbed the only weapon within reach, the dagger on his arm, and sliced the hand off at the wrist. The drudge screeched as Hart kicked it in the chest, pushing it into the lethal horde. Dagger clutched in his white-knuckled grasp. Hart slashed without thought or direction, clearing an opening above him. He crawled on top of the corpses, kicking free of a drudge clutching his ankle. He tumbled over the savage congregation until he got his feet beneath him. Bleeding and winded, he hurled himself off a drudge's back, landing and rolling onto the ground and staggering to his feet before he could get buried again. The house was about 30 yards in front of him. He had enough time to think, it may as well be 1,000, before he was hacking away at another onslaught. He knew he couldn't outrun so many, but he sprinted ahead anyway as the bite in his calf screamed at him to stop. Each time a hand reached for him, he hacked it away with his remaining machete. Each time teeth grazed his throat, he jabbed with the dagger. Each time they tried to stop him, he escaped. More and more disembodied souls gathered and swelled around him as he staggered and pitched and reeled his way to the house, blood dripping into one of his eyes and streaming out of his nose and trickling down his throat and soaking into his clothes. He swung his blades, hacking bodies into pieces. He coughed and spat blood, and still he went on, yard by yard, foot by foot. He tumbled onto the steps of the front porch with a drudge over his back. He used the momentum of his fall to grab it and throw it onto the wood planks. Then he slammed the dagger into the thing's appendix. The soul billowed out as he pulled the blade free with a wet suck and got to his knees. Another drudge came for him as he reached for the doorknob, grabbing his arm and tearing the flesh of his forearm free of his body with blood-stained teeth. Blinded by pain, Hart howled in agony. The dagger fell from his useless hand and clattered on his front porch. His front porch. He didn't care if this was the house of the unknown god or his own death waiting for him in Tanria, disguised as the place where he grew up. As far as he was concerned, this was his home. He had been rocked asleep in his grandfather's lap on that old swing. He had sat beside his mother on these steps, each of them holding a dripping ice cream cone. He refused to fail here. This was his fucking house. Gritting his teeth, Hart swung the machete and took off the drudge's head. He dragged himself the last 2 feet to the door on one hand and two knees. Throwing himself back on his heels with a shout of pain, he reached past the lights of all the souls gathering at the door and grasped the knob with his good hand. The door was locked. He tried again. Locked. He waved away the souls billowing around his face, and with one last grunt of effort, he slammed the blade of the machete into the wood, but the door remained shut against him. "This door was never locked a day in my life," he shouted, the words slurring one into the other over his broken teeth. Then he remembered that there was a reason why people were given a key at birth, a reason why the ID tag around his neck was in the shape of a key. With a shaking hand, he pulled the chain from around his neck and fumbled for his Birdsall and Son tag, shoved it into the lock, and tried to turn it. The lock held firm. The tumblers didn't move. "Fuck you," he hurled at the warden, the god who should have been waiting at the door, as two more drudges mounted the steps. He unsheathed his rapier, skewering first one, then the other. The souls flew free into the darkening sky. More were coming. He was going to die here. He could feel his life leaking out of him. As his mind clung to thoughts of Duckers and Alma and Diane and Mercy and Mercy and Mercy, he was so relieved to know that he was mortal after all. He dropped the rapier and grasped his mother's key in death-drunk fingers, pushing it into the lock and turning it clockwise. There was an answering click as the tumblers rolled into place. His chest flaring with hope, Hart pulled himself to his feet and twisted the knob. The door was heavy, so heavy, like lead rather than wood. He pushed hard, but it barely moved. A groan dribbled out of his mouth as he leaned his shoulder against the wood and put his body into it, nudging it open inch by inch. He bled into the wood grain. His whole body burned with pain. There was something wrong with his lungs. All he could do was this one thing, this slow opening of a door that only he could see. A strange silence thundered behind him. He watched the amber light of a single soul hover over his shoulder, then drift into the house. Another soul followed. 5 more, 10, dozens. Hart shoved harder, slid himself into the opening, propped his foot against the jamb, and held the door open with his body as the weight of it resisted, threatening to crush him. The souls came rushing in, raising a violent wind that whipped around him and tore through him, tugging at his bones. One by one, the bodies of the drudges in the meadow and beyond dropped to the earth as the dead came home at last. He cried out, a long, strangled vowel. But he would not let go, would not leave this spot until all the lost souls of Tanria had flown into the arms of the unknown god. He would not fail Bill this time, and he wouldn't fail Duckers or Mercy either. The souls kept coming, first in brightly lit waves, then sparsely, like embers popping from a fire. But the wind kept blowing into him. Hart's cry faded to breath, and his breath faded to nothing. His vision grayed and dimmed. The wind blew so strongly that his grip on the doorframe slipped, and he could no longer remember why he stood against it in the first place. He heard the soft liquid call of an equimeris, like the waves of the sea whispering over the sand when the tide goes out. And he turned his head to see Salt Licker on the edge of a field littered with bodies, bending his long neck to graze. Unable to hold on any longer, Hart let himself fly free. The wind carried him inside, and the last thing he saw was his own body dropping to the wooden floorboards of the porch as the door slammed shut behind him.
Chapter 37. The Birdsall family waited until the night following Mercy and Lil's triumph over Cunningham to celebrate. This was partially so that Mercy and Lillian could catch up on sleep, but mostly so that Zeddy could cook for them on his evening off. It coincided with Penn's last day of sick leave, so it was a farewell dinner as well. Pop rose from his seat at the head of the table and raised his glass. To my daughters! For the record, when you said that you wanted to take down Curtis Cunningham, putting yourselves in mortal danger was not what I had in mind. Lil held up her glass of grape juice. You say that like it's a bad thing. Not for the first time in the past 48 hours, Danny erupted, like water bursting through a dam. It is. Very bad. If you ever do something like that again, I'll... Oh! Lil cut him off, her face screwing up in pain. Do not fake a contraction to get out of trouble with me. There. It's gone. I'm sure it was gas. You were saying? Danny's anger drained out of his face. Was that a contraction? No. I'm having these tiny pains here and there, mostly in my back, but I'm fine. Mercy set down her wine goblet. Lil, are you in labor? No, no. I'm sure the cramping is from indigestion. At regular intervals? I guess. Like contractions? Lillian went pale. Maybe? Okay, then. Mercy turned to her brother. Why don't you go see if Dr. Galdamez is at home?
I'd protest, but I don't want to be here when her water breaks. That sounds disgusting. Pen, are you coming with?
Yes, please.
The way Penn launched himself from his chair made it clear that he was in agreement with his boyfriend. Once they were out the door, Pop, Danny, and Mercy watched Lillian as they picked at their food. After several minutes of her family's gawking and poor attempts at light conversation, Lil glared at them. I'm a pregnant woman, not a bomb that's about to go off.
Oh, except this one is starting to hurt.
Danny grasped his wife's hand.
Are you okay, honey?
Mother of fucking sorrows!
Danny squeaked in pain, so Mercy reached over and gently peeled her sister's fingers off her brother-in-law's pulverized bones.
I hope Dr. Galdamez gets here soon.
Did someone say Dr. Galdamez?
Zeddy said, as he and Penn walked through the front door.
She's here? Thank the gods, said Mercy.
No, she's out on a house call, but I left a message with her husband.
Lil made a gurgle of rage that sounded like a feral equimeris ready to duke it out in a fight pool. Mercy and Danny shared a look of mutual despair. Pop was the sole Birdsall who didn't seem concerned, chuckling as he got up from the table and sat in his recliner. He unfolded his newspaper and brought his glasses from his eyebrows to the end of his nose.
Her contractions aren't even 10 minutes apart yet. We've got hours to go.
We?
Lil bristled.
Hours?
Danny puled, gazing at his crushed fingers.
I'm not sticking around for this, said Zeddy.
Co-signed, said Penn.
Their duty discharged, they spirited themselves away upstairs, and soon the sounds of horseplay and giggling could be heard coming from Zeddy's room.
Can Zeddy and Penn refrain from getting it on while I'm giving birth?
Said Lillian, as Danny guided her to sit down in one of the armchairs in the parlor.
Seems like at least one person in this house should be able to have fun tonight, Danny murmured to Mercy. Or two, I guess.
There was a knock at the front door. Mercy hoped it was Dr. Galdamez, but between Lillian's occasional bursts of profanity and Zeddy and Penn's antics upstairs, Mercy suspected she was more likely to find an irate neighbor on the doorstep. Instead, Marshals Twyla Banneker and Frank Ellis stood on the front porch, completely out of context on the threshold of the family home rather than at the Birdsall and Son dock. Frank doffed his hat, but it was Twyla who spoke.
Hi, Mercy. Sorry to bother you, but we came to let you know that the Joint Chiefs of the Tanrian Marshals have petitioned the governor of Bouchong to mandate the opening of all undertakers along the Tanrian border until further notice, and it's already been approved.
Pop levered himself out of his chair and stood behind Mercy.
What's going on?
I'm not sure, but from what I've heard, there are uninfected cadavers all over Tanria. You can expect a huge intake tonight.
Lillian gripped the arms of her chair, her fingers like talons.
Fuck the salt fucking sea!
We have a bit of a situation here, Mercy pointed out.
I'm sorry, but you are required by law to open. Now. We need every berth we can get in every single town.
Frank nudged Twyla.
We've still got to get to Argentine and Mayetta.
He nodded to Mercy and Roy and said, apologies for the inconvenience, before putting on his hat and hopping into the waiting auto duck with his partner.
Zeddy and Penn were now standing at the bottom of the stairs. They must have caught the gist of the report, because Penn's lips thinned, and he headed upstairs toward the bedrooms.
Where are you going? Zeddy asked, following him.
To get my pack.
Their heated discussion could be heard in the parlor, the words muffled and indistinct, but the tones crystal clear.
I don't like this, Zeddy persisted, dogging Penn's path down the stairs a minute later. It sounds dangerous.
It's a dangerous job, Z.
You've barely recovered from the last time you were nearly killed on the job. If you were needed, I'm sure...
Zeddy paused, glanced at Mercy, and lowered his voice, although not enough to prevent her from hearing every word.
I'm sure you know who would have come to get you by now.
I'm sure he's already there, probably in the thick of it.
Penn slung his pack over his shoulder.
God's tits and testicles, you don't even know what it is.
Penn took Zeddy by the cheeks and planted a deep kiss on his mouth. Then he pressed his forehead to Zeddy's.
I love you. I love you too,
Zeddy whispered in defeat.
They stood like that for long seconds before Penn said,
This is such a great exit, but I just realized. I need you to drive me to the station.
Mercy grabbed her purse and prodded Leonard until he rolled off the sofa.
Can you drop me off on the way?
I'm coming with you, said Pop.
No.
Nope.
You're going to need help tonight.
Your sister is going to be fine. Trust me.
You're leaving me? All of you?
Fucking fuck the warden up the ass with Grandfather Bones' fucking tibia!
For someone ushering new life into the world, you sure know how to invoke the gods of death, Zeddy told Lillian, before turning to Penn.
I'm super mad at you, but all things considered, driving you to the station is probably my best option at the moment.
Penn ruffled Zeddy's hair.
Childbirth is a beautiful thing.
I hate you all,
said Lillian, as Danny hugged each of them in turn.
I think I might be getting the better deal out of this, Mercy told him.
He shot her a wary look.
Pray for me.
With Zeddy behind the wheel and Pop installed in the passenger seat, Mercy hopped into the hold of the old auto duck with Penn, and off they went, bobbing as the duck trundled up the brick street. Penn gave her a tight smile, and Mercy realized that he was scared to go into Tanria. She thought of his words to Zeddy.
It's a dangerous job, Z.
And Hart's voice answered in her mind.
Comes with the territory.
A thick unease settled in her belly. In theory, she had relinquished the right to concern herself with Hart's well-being, but her heart refused to receive that memo. She squeezed Penn's arm.
Take care, all right?
Buried in her words was, take care of Hart, too. She sensed that he understood what she meant without her having to say it.
I will.
There were already two sets of marshals out front by the time they pulled up to Birdsall and Son. Mercy hugged Penn hard before he switched places with her father. She watched the auto duck climb Main Street before she and Pop walked up the steps to the boardwalk in front of the family business.
Go ahead and pull around back. We'll meet you at the dock, Mercy told the marshals as she unlocked the front door.
How many berths do we have open in the well?
Pop asked her as he followed her in.
Most were cleared out for tomorrow's delivery. Not that Danny's going to be able to take them if Lil's having a baby tonight. That also means we're pretty crowded on the dock. We've got two going to the burial pits and one going to the pyres later this week. So that leaves 9 open berths in the well. Surely we won't get 9 in one day.
By now, they had made it to the dock and heaved up the gate. Mercy had assumed the two sets of partners would have one corpse each, but in fact, they had 5 between them. Her breath hitched.
5?
Yes, ma'am.
One of the marshals confirmed as she wheeled the first one in. Mercy thought her name was Rosie, but she couldn't remember her surname. She usually worked out of the East Station, so they almost never saw her at Birdsall's.
What in the salt sea is happening?
Roy asked.
Was there some kind of accident?
Not that we can tell.
Judges started dropping dead all over Tanria for no discernible reason. There are bodies everywhere.
They hadn't finished wheeling all five bodies into the boatworks lift before the next auto duck backed down the alley. "We need a plan," Mercy told her father, stress making her pulse speed up. "Any thoughts?" "I say that if they're in bad condition, we salt and wrap them immediately. If they're fairly fresh, we stow them in the well. If we run out of room, we leave the ones in the best condition downstairs against the walls outside the well. It's not as cold as inside the well, but it's cooler down there than it is up here." Mercy blew out a steadying breath. "Okay. Right. Good thing one of us remembered to order more salt last week," Roy gasped. "I completely forgot. I know. That's why I took care of it on Bones Day." Mercy rubbed her weary eyes. She was already tired, and the night had barely begun. Roy wrapped his heavy arm around her shoulders like a much-needed blanket. "It's going to be hard, but it won't last forever. We'll grit our teeth and get through it." "Right. But don't overdo it. I'll be good. I promise." It took them an hour or so to work out a rhythm. Pop assessed the condition of each corpse and sorted them, while Mercy carted bodies down the lift and stowed them as best she could. Every time another cadaver, or two or three, arrived, Mercy met the marshals at the dock and pinned the paperwork to each body's sailcloth until she and Pop could fill it all out. To Mercy's surprise, Zeddy arrived shortly after midnight with sandwiches and stale cream puffs in hand. "What are you doing here?" she asked him as he set the food on the counter in the kitchenette.
"It was a zoo at the station when I dropped Penn off. I figured you could use some fortification tonight."
"Bless you. Any word on what's going on?"
"Apparently, most of the bodies seem to be coming from the central sectors, whatever that means."
The wisp of a memory surfaced, but Mercy couldn't recall why the central sectors should have any significance to her. She shrugged it off and took a bite of a ham sandwich. Leave it to Zeddy to throw together a ham sandwich that tasted like a 4-star meal. He shuffled his feet as he watched her chew.
"I thought I might help you and Pop tonight, if I don't pass out first."
A warm glow lit up Mercy from within. "Think you can handle the paperwork, as long as the body is already salted and wrapped?" His skin took on a pallid green hue, but he said,
"I'll do my best."
She threw down her sandwich and hugged him, pinning his arms to his sides. "I love you."
"Gross."
She let go and smacked him in the chest as Pop noticed them in the kitchenette. He looked at the sandwiches and cream puffs, then at his son.
"Someone raised you right."
They got to work, Zeddy on the dock, clipboard in hand, and Mercy and Pop in the boatworks, salting and wrapping. The ribs of a half-finished vessel had to be shoved against the wall to make room for the human remains stacking up. None of the bodies appeared to be marshals, which went a long way toward alleviating Mercy's concern for duckers, and anyone else who might be a Tanrian marshal. As the hours passed, the outside world disappeared. Mercy swam in a sea of death and salt and sailcloth. Her red transistor sat silent and watching as she worked side by side with Pop. She had no idea what time it was when Zeddy stepped into the doorway.
"Mercy?"
"Hmm?" She kept her focus on her work. There was so much work to do. Work behind her, before her, ahead of her. Pop nudged her to get her attention, because Zeddy wasn't alone. Penn stood behind him, and next to Penn was Alma McGuire. The grim set of the chief's jaw made that tiny pinprick of worry for Hart expand into a gaping pit inside Mercy. "Have either of you seen Marshal Ralston come in this evening?"
"No,"
Pop answered. Everyone looked to Mercy, and her mouth went dry. "I'm sure he's dropping off bodies like everyone else." Alma stepped closer.
"He was on sick leave, but we got word that he entered Tanria through the North Station this morning. They said he was armed to the teeth, like he knew something was going to happen. And now I've got hundreds of bodies on my hands. Disinfected drudges by the look of it. But no Ralston. Every other marshal assigned to the West Station is accounted for, except him. If you have any information, no matter how small or insignificant it might seem to you, I'd appreciate it if you could let us know."
The words dropped on Mercy like a load of bricks. Hart was missing, and hundreds of unexplained dead bodies had shown up all over Tanria. A lump of helplessness throbbed in her throat as she thought of Hart sitting on her settee, staring past her as he told her what had happened all those years ago, when he and Bill had tried to send the lost souls into the afterlife. the weight of his voice a shadow of the burden he had carried around inside him for so long.
There's a field in the middle of Tanria where his first partner died years ago. Have you searched there?
Alma's brow furrowed.
That was in Sector 28.
Why would he go there? Pen asked, his alarm contagious.
Telling Alma and Pen where Hart might have gone was one thing. Telling them why he might be there, even if they were his friends, was a betrayal of his trust that Mercy couldn't bring herself to break.
You'll have to ask him that yourself, when you find him.
And you have good reason to believe he went there?
More bodies coming in, Zeddy murmured from the open doorway.
Mercy gazed at Alma, feeling more helpless by the second.
Yes, I think that's where he went.
Alma patted Pen on the shoulder.
Let's go.
Mercy stood there, frozen, listening as Alma told the marshals on the dock to meet her at the station. Zeddy kissed Pen goodbye again, then leaned against the door jamb of the boatworks, his chartreuse pants oddly lively, given his surroundings. Pop put an arm around Mercy.
I'm sure he's fine.
Mercy nodded, but without much conviction. Zeddy cleared his throat.
Is he mortal?
I mean, maybe he can't,
you know.
Mercy wanted Hart to be alive more than anything in the world. But as she mulled over Zeddy's words, a horrible sadness filled her.
That's the last thing he'd want.
She took off her glasses and pressed the heels of her hands to her eyes, pushing against the tears. She couldn't help Hart now, but she could respect the final wishes of the unfortunates who had been delivered to Birdsall and Sun tonight. She put her glasses on, blew her nose on the handkerchief that she kept in her pocket, and nodded at Pop.
Let's get to work.
For the next several hours, they sorted, salted, wrapped, and stowed. Exhaustion tugged on Mercy's bones, but she treated each body with care and sang the incantations with as much fervor for the 20th salting and wrapping as she had for the first. She gave all of them the dignity they deserved at the end, even as her worry for Hart pulled hard at her attention. When she caught Pop leaning on the prep table, she sent him to the lobby to take a break. But there was no break for Mercy. The bodies kept coming, many of them from Sector 28. Mercy wouldn't and couldn't think about what that meant. The dead needed her more than the living. By the time the painter brushed the eastern horizon in shades of lavender and pink, there was no more room left on the dock, in the well, or on the floor around the well. The salt ran low, and there was only enough sailcloth left to wrap two, maybe three more bodies. A lull finally hit around 5 in the morning. Mercy was teetering on her feet, so tired she hadn't noticed that Pop had come into the boatworks until his arm was around her.
Come on, let's have a sit.
He guided her 4 steps toward the door before she protested, pulling away from him.
I can't. I have to work.
You need to rest.
No, Muffin. There are too many things to worry about right now. Too many people to worry about. And if I stop working, I'm going to have to think about them.
You're not doing them any good if you're dead on your feet.
He guided her toward the door again, and she let him. Both of them bone-weary, they shuffled down the hall to the lobby.
I know your sister is one of your worries. Mine too. But it's going to be fine.
Your mom yelled at me for 20 hours before the three mothers finally forked over your key.
Mercy let out a watery laugh and dropped into a chair. Pop sat down beside her, and Zeddy came out of the kitchenette with a mug of coffee for each of them.
If you tell Pop he can't have a cup of coffee, I will beat you.
She laughed again, doing her best to keep her concerns at bay.
You're a terrible influence, Zeddy, but I'm glad you stayed to help tonight.
They heard footsteps pounding up the boardwalk seconds before Danny burst into the room, panting from his run over. A grin spread from rosy cheek to rosy cheek.
Emma Jane is here! 7 pounds, 2 ounces! Lil did great! Everyone's fine!
Mercy couldn't hear the sound of her own cheers over her father's and brother's. She took turns with Pop and Zeddy to hug the breath out of Danny before fetching a plate of celebratory cream puffs from the kitchenette. Danny's cheeks glowed as he gushed.
You should have seen Lil. She was amazing. I don't know how she... And Bride of Fortune, Emma Jane is perfect. Perfection. Wait until you see her toes.
They toasted mother and child with cream puffs and hugged Danny a few more times before sending him home.
I thought he was about to give us a play-by-play of the birth, Zeddy said, after ushering his brother-in-law out the door. Thank gods he veered off that topic. I don't think I could have handled the details.
Zeddy was still holding open the door when Alma stepped into the lobby, her eyes bloodshot, her mouth drawn tight across her face. The pit that had opened up inside Mercy earlier in the night stretched far and wide, dark as a moonless night, threatening to swallow her whole.
Did you?
She began, but the rest of the words refused to exit her mouth.
We found him.
Alma's bottom lip trembled. She took a shaky breath before she spoke again.
I'm sorry, Mercy. He's sailed the salt sea.
Chapter 38. When her mother died, Mercy had imagined herself diving into the deep end of a swimming pool and staying there, her senses muted and muffled, her body cold and weightless. The same sensation overtook her now, the blessed feeling of not feeling anything.
Where's Penn? Zeddy asked, his voice heavy with worry.
Parked out back with the remains. He's taking it hard. We all are, Alma told him. What did that mean, to take something hard? Mercy didn't want to take it at all, hard or soft or in between. Whatever it was, she was certain to bash against its sharp edges and break. Alma glanced at her. But whatever she saw made her look to Roy instead. The body's too tall for a dolly, so we're going to have to bring him in on a stretcher, unless you prefer that we take him somewhere else. Given the circumstances, Alma's words yanked Mercy out of her icy numbness.
No, he stays here.
Maybe it's better if he goes to Faber and Sons, Muffin.
Pop took her hands in his, but Mercy found no comfort in the gesture. She was so cold that she couldn't stop shivering.
No,
she repeated, her tone as hollow as she felt.
Then let me take care of this one.
This one. The remains. The body. They were all talking about Hart as if he were no longer here. Because he wasn't. He was gone. He had sailed the salt sea. Another unbearable euphemism. Why couldn't anyone say what he was? Dead. Hart was dead.
I'll do it, Mercy insisted. Muffin, he bought a package from us, and we're going to honor it. It's what we do here. You've already overextended yourself, Pop, so I'll take care of him.
Mercy, I need to take care of him.
Alma studied her, her demigod eyes made more luminescent by unshed tears, and she nodded. Behind her, Mercy could see Zeddy take a sobbing Pen into his arms and walk him toward the kitchenette.
Can you help me bring him in? Alma asked Roy, but Mercy answered for him.
He can't. Doctor's orders. I'll help you.
Mercy faced another probing look from the chief marshal before Alma acquiesced. Do you want him in the lift?
That depends. What's the condition of the body?
The body. Even Mercy was sidestepping the harsh reality of death. Alma sniffed hard, and a single tear dropped down her left cheek.
He's in bad shape.
Bad shape meant he'd been in pain when he died. But he wasn't in pain now, so Mercy did her best to shove the thought to the side. She'd deal with it later. Right now, Hart needed her to do her job.
We'll put him directly on the prep table, she said.
She followed Alma onto the dock and took the first breath of fresh air she'd had in hours, before they climbed into the hold of the auto duck. A corpse wrapped in sailcloth lay on a stretcher, directly on the floor, too long to fit in any of the berths. There were several places where blood had stained the winding sheet.
Pain. He was in pain.
The thought screamed through Mercy, but the anonymity of the sailcloth covering his face allowed her to ram it out of the way. Together, she and Alma lifted their burden. He was heavy, but both women were strong. They carried him the short distance to the boatworks and set the remains on the table. Alma helped Mercy maneuver the stretcher out from underneath the body.
Are you sure about this?
Alma asked.
I can handle it.
I can't handle this, said a voice deep inside herself.
Well, I don't think I can, so I'll leave you to it.
Alma reached across the table and brushed Mercy's arm before leaving her alone with the corpse of Hart Ralston.
Mercy had told him that she didn't want to see him again, and he had honored her wishes. Now, as she braced herself to see his remains, she'd give anything to hear the ding of the front bell and walk into the lobby to find him standing at the counter.
She could hear Alma and Pop speaking in low voices out front, and Zeddy comforting Pen in the kitchenette with a combination of soft words and caresses and stale cream puffs. Yet the silence of the boatworks reached down her throat, threatening to fill her with a grief that would level her. She reached for the precious transistor Hart had given her, wound the crank, and flipped the switch to on. A trumpet blared into the boatworks, and she hurriedly spun down the volume dial until the music played softly. She didn't know the song, but it was an upbeat big band number, the sort of thing she usually loved to listen to as she worked. It made what she was about to do seem normal, mundane. She willed her hands steady. Then she unwrapped him.
I can't handle this, she thought again.
But her hands kept working, muscle memory taking over as her mind shrank from what she saw before her on the table. His entire body was a catalog of agony. Mercy swallowed a sob. Get to work, she told herself. His clothing was unsalvageable, so she cut it away with scissors. She heard the rustle of paper in his vest pocket as she pulled the garment free of his stiffening arms, and she made a mental note to retrieve whatever it was once she had him cleaned and salted and wrapped. The shirt went, the dungarees, the underwear, and the one sock and boot he'd come in with, the other set left behind on a Tanrian field. She made a neat pile on the floor, remembering the careful way Hart had folded her overalls while she took a bath. She pushed the memory away as hard as she could. All that remained was the chain around his neck with his mother's birth key and his shiny new Birdsall and Son ID tag. But she couldn't bring herself to remove them yet. She cried while she bathed him. Not a deluge, but a slow, steady leak as she rinsed the blood and dirt from his cool, pale skin. He appeared more at peace now that he was clean, but also less like his living self. The wet keys glistened in the gaslight. Mercy touched the metal, fingering them the way she had when Hart was in her bed, her head resting in the crook of his shoulder, a concavity that seemed at once thin and cavernous in death. My nuzzle nook, she thought without meaning to. Grief rammed into her so hard she dropped the hose and cried out when the cold water doused her shoes and one of her pant legs. Still crying, she turned off the tap and gripped the table. Pop appeared in the doorway. He looked haggard, but if he knew what a wreck she was, he'd barrel his way in and insist on taking care of Hart himself when what he needed more than anything was a good night's sleep. Everything all right? He asked. Mercy swiped at the tears staining her cheeks. Fine. I dropped the hose. That's all. He walked across the room and stood opposite her, with Hart's corpse between them. But his focus was entirely on his daughter. How are you doing? I'm fine. Anything I can do? You can go home and meet your granddaughter and rest. I will, but I want to go over a few things with you and Chief McGuire when she gets back. Where did she go? To let her wife know. I guess they were close. Her name's Diane, Mercy told her father, remembering the warmth in Hart's voice when he had talked about her. Leonard whined in the lobby. Probably needs to go out, Mercy said, the weight of exhaustion settling into her soul. It was bizarre to think of doing something as normal as letting her dog out to pee when Hart was dead and gone. He needed her to take care of him, but she had to take care of the living first, and it rankled her. I'll do it, said Pop. But Leonard's whines grew so sharp and pronounced that she followed him to the lobby anyway. The dog was pacing back and forth, skittish. Mercy tried to pet him, but he ducked away from her hand and barked, though there was nothing to bark at. She opened the door and tried to coax him outside, but he wouldn't go. He liked Marshall Ralston, didn't he? Pop said quietly. Mercy knew what he was getting at. A hard knot formed in her throat. She nodded. "Leonard, come," she called, moving toward the boatworks and the body of a man whose life had departed. Her dog followed her, sniffing the air as they got closer. She had Leonard sit beside the prep table, and she crouched down to be with him. "He's gone," she told him, stroking his ears. "I'm sorry." Leonard put his front paws on the table and sniffed the body, knocking Hart's hand loose so that it dangled off the table's surface. His nubbin tail wagged, then stopped. He whimpered piteously, a sound that echoed the keening ache inside Mercy. She wanted to bury her face in Leonard's brindle coat and feel his warmth against her cheek and hear his heart beating beneath his ribcage, but he yelped and bolted out of the room, leaving her alone with her sorrow. Mercy took Hart's dangling hand, intending to put it on the table at his side. Instead, she intertwined her warm fingers with his cold, lifeless ones. She wished that she could sob to get it out of the way so that she could do all the things that needed doing. But as she clutched Hart's frigid hand and made herself look at his battered face, the tears refused to come. There was a knock at the front door, and Mercy bowed her head in frustration. "You've got to be kidding me. Pop, can you get that?" In answer, her father's cigar smoke wafted in from the dock. He probably couldn't hear her or the knock. "Zeddy?" There was no answer. He was probably camped out in her apartment with Penn, or maybe they had gone home. And that left her to answer the door. She kissed Hart's palm, although she didn't have a right to do so, she thought with a guilt-laden pang, and set his hand down at his side. The sounds of an argument on the other side of the door greeted her as she stepped into the lobby. "What fresh nightmare is this?" she asked Leonard, who gave her a sad wheeze from the chair that he wasn't supposed to be on, apparently recovered from whatever had bothered him earlier. She opened the door to find Horatio chewing out a nimkillum she had never seen before, a hard-bitten rabbit with a gold loop through one ear.
"You are infringing on my territory! The good people of Eternity do not need ruffians soiling their streets!"
"Well, fuck you very much."
Horatio flapped a dismissive wing at the rabbit and addressed Mercy.
"My apologies, Miss Birdsall. I shall deal with this cur forthwith."
The other nimkillum marched past Mercy, lobbing his argument over his shoulder as he strode straight for the boatworks.
"Federated Postal Code 27-C clearly states..."
"Excuse me,"
cried Mercy, rushing after him alongside Horatio.
"That in cases of decease, any undelivered mail is retrieved by the nimkillum of record, which is me."
When Horatio hooted in outrage, the strange nimkillum stopped and added,
"Suck on that,"
poking the owl in his puffed breast feathers.
"Remove your phalanges from my person at once before I am forced to do you harm."
"Please, I could wipe the floor with your tail feathers and still have time for a drink at the pub,"
the rabbit answered as he stepped into the boatworks. Privately, Mercy agreed with that assessment, which was why she was not prepared when Horatio walloped the rabbit from behind and wrestled him to the floor. She scurried out of the way, pressing herself against the wall in shock and disgust as the nimkillum fought each other next to Hart's body. They rolled into the soiled clothing, wreaking havoc on Mercy's neat pile, both of them reaching for the vest and tearing it in half in the process with a violent rip. It was Horatio who came up victorious, waving a letter about in triumph as he declared,
"Aha! To the victor go the spoils!"
But his triumph evaporated when he read the address, and he gazed at Mercy with mournful eyes.
"Oh, my dear, I am so sorry."
Bewildered, Mercy looked to the other nimkillum, but his attention was now on Hart.
"Aw, no, not him."
The rabbit stood on tiptoe to better see the body on the table.
"No, no, no, you fucking asshole."
He tugged a red handkerchief from his pocket and sobbed into it.
"You can deliver it if you like,"
Horatio told him, holding out the letter, his feathers ruffled, his cravat a mess. The other nimkillum blew hard into his hanky and shook his head.
"You do it."
"You knew Hart?" Mercy asked.
"Let me see you."
The rabbit approached her and studied her long and hard.
"You know what? I bet you were probably worth it."
He took the letter from Horatio and delivered it to Mercy.
Mail for you, friend.
Mercy took the envelope from his paw. One corner was stained brown with Hart's blood, but the address was clearly legible.
2. Mercy Birdsall. Care of Birdsall and Son Undertakers. 26 Main Street, Eternity, Bouchon.
After all this time, her friend had finally written back to her.
Well, I could do with a drink, said Horatio.
That makes 2 of us. First one's on me, offered the other Nimkilim,
and they let themselves out. Mercy glanced at Hart's stiffening body before prying open the envelope with numb fingers and reading his last letter to her.
Dear friend, strike that. My dearest, strike that. Mercy. My name is Hart Ralston. I could tell you that I'm tall and have blonde hair and gray eyes. I could tell you that my favorite color is yellow, because your favorite color is yellow. I could tell you that I'm a demigod and a Tanrian marshal, and as I informed you in my first letter, a dickhead. I could even try to tell you that I'm your friend. But how can I in good conscience claim that title? A friend doesn't lie or hide the truth the way I did. This is my roundabout way of saying, I'm sorry. Not I'm sorry, but I'm sorry, full stop. I was afraid you wouldn't feel for me what I have come to feel for you, strike that, have felt for you since the day I walked into Birdsall and Son and found a woman there who was color and light and joy in a world that had come to seem colorless and dismal and lousy to me. But that's not an excuse. There's no excuse for keeping the truth from you. I'm weak. That's all I can say for myself. I am not a good man, as you well know, but at least I can tell you with absolute certainty that I am a better man for having known you. My letters to you have allowed me to be my best self the only way I know how, since I can't seem to make the right words come out of my mouth when I need them. And being with you, the real you, gods, what can I say? What words could do justice to the precious time you gave me? You've made me want to live my life rather than spend my time worried about my mortality, or lack thereof. Maybe that's a mixed blessing, but it's more a blessing than a curse. So thank you, Mercy, for inspiring me to be better than I am. You have always been merciful, whatever my stupid, foolish mouth has said to the contrary. You once told me that I had a rapier for a heart and a depressing novel lodged in my appendix, but the truth is that if anyone bothered to scratch my brittle, craggy surface, they would find that my heart and soul belong entirely and completely to Mercy Birdsall, the best human being whose surface I have ever had the privilege of scratching. If I were brave, I'd send this letter to you. If I were braver, I'd destroy it. But I'm not brave and never was, not like you. So I'll keep it tucked beside my heart, unsent and unread, until the day I die. If I die. And who knows? Maybe then it will make its way to you somehow. My words too late, as always, and never worthy of you to begin with. I hope one day you'll give your heart to someone good and decent, and that you will cherish his heart in return. But it's a rare man who deserves you. So I'll leave you with this. I wish you a happy life, surrounded by the people you love and who love you in return. Your friend, strike that. Sincerely, strike that. Love, Heart.
Mercy's eyes drifted from the page in her hand, past the body on the table, all the way to a point frozen in time, when she sat, miserable and alone, at a table in the Little Wren Cafe, believing her friend had stood her up. Except he hadn't stood her up. He had been there all along, right in front of her, and she had failed to see him for who he was. He had sat across the table from her, sipping his tea, his gray eyes cool and shuttered as he spoke, a challenge in his voice.
Maybe there are things about me that would surprise you, Merciless, if you bothered to scratch the surface.
One moment, she was standing against the boatworks wall. The next, she was bent over Hart's body, clutching the letter and clinging to an arm that could no longer hold her in return. She sobbed into the perfect curve where his shoulder met his neck, the spot that was supposed to belong to her for a long, long time.
"I'm still waiting for you to do something stupid," he whispered in her mind.
"I was stupid all along," she wept.
But he couldn't hear her now. Not where he was.
Chapter 39. Hart stole a cookie from the cooling rack on the counter when his mom wasn't watching. He had almost reached the back door when she asked, "Where are you going?" His hand was on the knob. He didn't face her because he didn't want her to see the cookie in his guilty hand, the still warm chocolate chips melting all over his fingers.
"Down by the creek," he said.
"Okay, put on your jacket."
"I'm fine, it's not cold."
"Jacket." He rolled his eyes as he yanked his jacket off the coat hook, then sailed through the door and down the steps.
"Hartley James, put on your jacket,"
Mom shouted at him from the kitchen window, but there was laughter in her voice.
"I will. It doesn't do you any good if you're not wearing it. Okay, bye, Mom, love you,"
he hollered over his shoulder, the jacket flapping in the wind as he ran, trailing from his hand like a kite.
"Love you too."
The sun shone bright in a cloudless sky, and the air was the perfect temperature, cool but not too cool. He ran past the chickens and the vegetable plot and waved at Grandpa, who was checking the rain gauge in the barley field. By the time Hart reached the creek, Gracie was at his heels, yipping. He found a stick and hurled it as far as he could and watched as she raced after it, lithe and swift as a deer. She brought it back to him and set it at his feet, her tongue lolling out of her mouth. The game of fetch went on for what felt like hours. Gracie was tireless, and Hart had nowhere he needed to be and nothing he needed to do. But as the sun arced high and began to drop toward the western horizon, he decided it was time to head home. He walked past the cattle, which lowed in protest as Gracie tried to herd them. But the dog came running when Hart gave a sharp whistle through his teeth. She followed him in through the screen door and sniffed Diane's orange tabby, who arched his back and skittered away. Hart helped himself to a soda. They always seemed to have an unending supply in the icebox. "Alma? Diane?" He stepped into the parlor, where dust motes floated in the shaft of afternoon sunlight pouring in through the open window. He took a sip of soda and liked the way the bubbles fizzed over his tongue. Bill had always insisted that soda would rot his teeth, but Hart couldn't help himself when he was at Alma and Diane's house. Bill. There was something about Bill that was supposed to make him sad, but he couldn't remember what it was. He crossed the room and opened the front door and stepped into the lobby of Birdsall and Son Undertakers, with a sensation akin to smacking into a wall. "I'm not supposed to be here," he thought with an accompanying dismay. "Duckers, let's move it," he spoke into the empty air. But no, Duckers wasn't with him this time, was he? "Gracie," he called, because he couldn't very well leave his dog behind. But then he remembered that Gracie wasn't supposed to be here either. This place belonged to a different dog. He wasn't sure of the name until it sneaked up on him and tripped off his tongue. "Leonard?" There was movement to his right. He turned his head and saw the boxer and other things lift his head from the arm of a chair he should not have been occupying. The dog's nubbin wagged. He jumped off the chair and ambled toward his favorite marshal. Hart tried to pet him, but Leonard grew skittish, pacing the floor and whining in equal parts. "Hey, what's the matter?" Hart asked him. Leonard barked in distress and fled down the hallway. The sound of a chair scooting away from a desk came from the office, followed by footfalls heading toward the door. A man came into the lobby, flipping through pages stuck to the clipboard in his hand. He startled when he noticed Hart. Then he studied the pages of his clipboard again.
Well, shit. I guess that's today.
Hart stood frozen to the spot, stunned, unsure what he should be feeling.
Bill? What? No.
The man glanced down at his body.
Oh, right, that makes sense.
He surveyed his surroundings.
Yeah, this all makes sense.
He looked at Hart again and gave him a fond smile.
Bill,
Hart said again, except this time, it wasn't a question.
No, sorry. You might not see Bill this go-round. He's holding on to a lot of guilt when it comes to you. Worried that you're not going to forgive him, when, obviously, you forgave him long ago, if you ever blamed him to begin with. Give him time. He'll come around.
Hart gaped at the man. He didn't know what to say, because this was definitely Bill, right down to the scar in his right eyebrow and the missing tips of the last two fingers of his left hand. The man chucked the clipboard onto the counter. He came closer, stopping a few feet in front of Hart.
I'm your dad.
Hart continued to stare at the man before him, who, as far as he was concerned, was his mentor and the only real father he'd ever had. At last he spoke, his tone even when his feelings were not.
There's no way Bill could have fathered me. I don't have a dad. I look like Bill in your mind, but I'm not. I'm the warden, you know, the guy who ushers souls into the house of the unknown god. They need help sometimes, the lost and lonely ones, hence me.
Hart felt like the floorboards were tilting beneath his boots.
By guy, you mean God?
Yep.
Right.
It was the only response he could muster. His mind was a blank.
Wow, Hartley James. I've waited 36 years for this day. Any chance I could get a hug?
The man who was not Bill and who claimed to be one of the gods of death, who, to Hart's knowledge, had never fathered a child in all of recorded history, took a step toward him. He took an answering step back. He wanted nothing to do with the warden, the father who was never there, the thing wearing Bill's skin as if he had any right to it. The warden stopped and held up his hands, Bill's hands.
Okay, no worries, I get it. I know you have some complicated feelings when it comes to me. Maybe it would be best if you called me Jeff.
Hart's jaw tightened. A familiar rage bled into his current state of confusion.
What is going on here, Jeff?
He said the name like a curse.
You came home. I don't have a home. Sure you do. Several, trust me. It's my job to know these things.
Hart exhaled in frustration as he glanced around the lobby. He knew this place. And he knew that he wasn't welcome here, although he was having trouble remembering why. It definitely was not his home. The warden leaned his elbow on the counter and clasped his fingers. The pleasant expression of his face turned commiserative.
We should talk. That ship sailed when you ditched my mom.
Warden dismissed Hart's resentment with a wave.
Well, I'm your dad, so too bad. We're talking.
Hart found himself sitting in a maple tree, on a limb that jutted out from the trunk in a nearly perpendicular line, matching the horizon. He knew this spot. It was his favorite climbing tree, the one that overlooked the west orchard. His feet dangled, and he kicked them through the air, first one, then the other, back and forth. The air smelled loamy, the scent of a plowed field before Grandpa seeded it. He didn't realize that the warden was sitting next to him until the god spoke.
I always thought that if I could have been a real dad, a normal dad, this is where we'd go when you had something you needed to say.
Hart regarded the warden, who still looked every inch like Bill. Then he turned his attention to the hazy pink and orange sky.
This is where I went when I wished I had a dad to talk to. I know.
Bitterness filled Hart's mouth, spilling acidity off his tongue.
What are you doing here?
Existing. What are you doing here?
Hart wanted to answer, but words eluded him. he took in the orchard and the familiar horizon beyond. He knew his house was behind him to his left, past the walnut grove. He was home. But it wasn't his home anymore, was it? Aunt Patty had sold this land years ago. What are you doing here? The question echoed in his head, and an answer slowly surfaced in his mind. There had been a field and a house, his house, and pain, so much pain. He had opened the door and had gone home. They'd all gone home, all the lost souls, his own included. The god was closer now. Heart stiffened when the warden's hand landed on his shoulder, but he didn't pull away.
I asked you a question, Heart. What are you doing here?
Dying, I guess, he answered, feeling empty and alone.
Mortals usually do.
So I am mortal?
Yep.
That was when he remembered Mercy, and the hurt that came with the memory made him wish he could forget her all over again. Except he didn't want to forget her. As soon as she returned to his mind, he latched on and refused to let go.
It'd be like reading a book that doesn't end, she told him in his mind. No matter how good the story is, you want it to be over at some point.
But she was wrong. Now that the grim, depressing novel that was his life had come to an end,